Then I would like to welcome you all to an episode of Vinhagornas 2.0, which translates to wine hags. So you're all from now on, you can add to your list of accomplishments in life, honorary wine hacks.
Wine yeah. hacks.
Thank you. So welcome.
My entire life for someone to say that to
So what we're going to do is we're going to talk a bit more about the documentary, Living Jesus. With me, I have Jeff, who is a former Presbyterian.
Yes.
Yes. I have Lindsay, who is a former Baptist. Yeah. I have Elena, former Mormon. And I have Dan, ex-charismatic Christian.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's basically like the faith movement. Mm-hmm. As I said to the other group, that what I have done when I watched the documentary is that all of your stories sort of gave me an impression or a word, a phrase, an expression that came to mind. And we're going to talk about these expressions because it's all part of the whole thing that is deconstructing one's faith or leaving one's faith. Mm-hmm. But first of all, I would like to say thank you to all of you for participating in this documentary. It meant a lot to me, and I know it's going to mean a lot to the people in Scandinavia and all over the world that has left their faith. The word that came to me when I saw the parts with you, Jeff.
Yes.
Was lost at sea. Mm. When I told you about this, what was your initial reaction? What did you think?
It's a complicated, and I feel like I'm a very complicated person.
Yeah.
And so I make things very difficult.
Yeah.
And I go round and round, and then I feel lost.
Yeah.
But that feels comfortable too at the same time.
Because it's something you know.
It's something I know. Yeah. I can get lost in my little world and keep complaining, keep medicating, yeah. keep spinning, all the while I'm hating myself.
Yeah.
And I'm spinning downward and downward, and I don't know how much I can want to explain to that, because I started listening to sermons, like.
Yeah, you talk about that in
yes,
the documentary.
In the documentary. Yeah. Because when I get in this downward spiral, it's a bottomless pit
yeah.
feeling. And so listening to this sermon, I can actually think, oh, my God, I know something.
Yeah.
It's like, that's bullshit.
Yes, and also I think it's a place that's familiar.
Yes.
And sometimes when you're lost, you just want something that's familiar.
Thank you.
As well. Yeah.
Exactly.
And I think it's because we tend to go back and forth. And that's why all of these different expressions and emotions that we're going to talk about it's part of it, because it's something maybe we visit one time, or it's something that we return to. Or it's something that we stay in for the most part, but it's, you sort of visit the different
yeah.
places. And the feeling of being lost at sea is, I think, something that everybody can relate to immensely, that has left their beliefs. Because what do? You invest a lifetime into something. And then it feels like one day it's just, boom, gone.
Gone.
It's like a all-consuming fire took your house. What do you do without all this?
Right. It started when I went to school, when I went to Bible college. And they started teaching me things that, whether Jesus was coming back before the tribulation, after the tribulation, and I started, and my mom would call me. We talk, and after the third year of college, I was panicking because I'm supposed to be teaching yeah. something, and I didn't feel like I was learning anything.
No.
So I felt lost, and that's not, I didn't know that at the time. I talked to her and I was vulnerable and said, I don't feel like I'm learning anything. And she got kind of in my face and said, no, you're going to graduate and you know, and you're going to teach. And I was taken aback by that
answer.
This
is what's going to happen for you,
yes.
Period.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And that started my process.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that at the time. I did not know what I was facing.
Yeah.
You know.
Because most of the time it's the small things that you don't realize it when you're going through it, but you can see it in the rear view mirror.
Yeah.
That was a significant point. Something happened there.
Yes.
And I thought of a part that you said in the documentary where you had the visit from the Mormon girls.
Yes. Yes, yes.
And you speak about this powerful experience of, you know, when you have the spiritual experience, that's the moment I knew that this was the right path.
Yeah.
And everything.
Right.
And you say that I never had that.
Right.
And that got me thinking, because I know a lot of people that have said the exact same thing, that I never had the experience. Or they say that they, you know, with speaking in tongues, and that they sort of faked the experience, or they had to fake the emotions. And my thought was, I had a bombardment of spiritual experiences.
Yeah.
And I still left because it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when you're in that lost at sea mental space, you think that there's something wrong with me because I can't feel this, and it's
correct.
Specific. But the thing is that the whole system is equally fucked up for people that have the experiences.
See, it's hard to see that.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like obviously alone is the big word, because everybody to me seemed to have it figured out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you come in contact with the Journey Free retreat?
Well, I listened to a alternative station in Seattle.
Okay.
And it's, they have everything on there. Even people who see UFOs or, you know, it's very different.
We had a paper called En Ding Ding Värld.
Oh, yeah.
In Sweden, where they would just, you know, combine all the things where I saw a UFO or my grandmother is Jesus. Basically, everybody that took LSD in between the years of 1975 till 1995, and they had them write articles about everything and printed everything. It was lovely.
Wow.
Yeah. So, sounds like that with the radio station.
It exactly sounds like that. And so I'm listening to different, you know, things that I like to listen to. And I can't remember exactly what that station was. But there was a man on the radio starting to talk about Christianity in a way I'd never heard of.
Really?
Like it's a cult.
Wow.
Like it's a mind fuck.
Yeah.
He didn't say that on the radio, and I pulled over instantly. And
yeah.
Yeah.
It's okay.
I just started crying. Because most people I talked to just said, yeah, I just kind of left that behind. No big deal.
And exactly.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. In America, to talk the way he's talking is really wrong.
Yeah.
And I called him, and I got a couple of like counseling sessions from him. It was a weird experience, though. He seemed shut down too, though. When I talked to him, I'm not sure, but he knows Marlene Winnell, and I found
the therapist, one of the therapists.
Yes.
Yeah.
I looked her up, and I found that I could go to an actual retreat.
Wow.
Yeah, and where people are sharing all in the same.
Yeah.
And he was not cheap. He was like $100 each session. I'm like, and this was a few hundred bucks to go to the retreat and be with so many people.
Yeah, and that is also one thing that I think we talk about not nearly enough, is how much the churches should pay us just in therapy fees.
Yeah, yeah,
for
yeah.
what we have to deal with.
Right.
Afterwards, yeah.
Yes.
So that, you made a financially wise decision
as well. Bang for my buck.
Yeah.
It is exactly it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lindsay, can I ask you, what is your experience with what we just talked about, the whole thing of feeling like you're lost at sea?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to say I agree about the emotional duress that it all causes,
yeah.
and that we should be able to collectively like file a class action lawsuit against
exactly.
the
yeah,
church
yeah, yeah, yeah.
and
Find
reparations.
Them.
Yeah, yeah. Seriously. Yeah, lost at sea. When I think about that phrase, what comes to mind for me is the concept of discerning God's will
yeah.
and discerning God's perfect plan for you. And I know that one of the contexts in which we've been talking about feeling lost at sea has to do with after leaving the church
yeah.
and feeling lost at sea then, like after you've lost like your church, your community, your family, your purpose, all of that.
Exactly. The small things in life.
Yeah, you know, little things. Yeah.
yeah.
But what immediately came to mind for me was actually the whole process of feeling lost at sea before I had actually deconstructed my faith and left. Mm-hmm. I felt so lost at sea all the time in the process of trying to magically discern God's will for me.
Yeah.
You know, and I was told there's this one perfect plan and path.
Exactly.
And yeah. I should kind of like be able to figure it out. And
you
just,
should devote your life
yeah.
to finding that path. And you go,
yeah.
wait, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just experienced so much grief and turmoil and torment over that, over
yeah.
trying to figure out like what the fucking path was that I was supposed to be going down. And if it was so important and so significant, so majestic and all these things, then like, why was it so hard for me to discern and figure
yeah.
out? So I felt lost all the time and almost felt cruel that God would like know exactly what this plan and path was for me, but kind of like
exactly.
dangle carrots all in front of me. And I'm just like following all these carrots around in life
yeah.
and like never actually reaching the carrot.
Oh,
yeah.
I know
so,
that feeling so well. You have this big ship that is your whole life in the Titanic, basically. And then the whole thing unravels, hits the iceberg, sinks, and you're stuck by yourself in a lifeboat at sea with no food. And the only feeling that you have is that you're basically fucked.
Yeah. Well, and we didn't even get to like get ourselves painted in the nude because that wasn't allowed. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly.
So it's like, what the fuck?
So all the bad parts
yeah.
and none of the fun stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. when you, Jeff, when you first visited the retreat, how was the sensation to meet other people that were basically in a similar situation to yours?
Unfortunately, I had mixed. Well, I don't know if it's unfortunate. I had mixed feelings.
Yeah.
Because I was afraid to become part of another group.
Yeah, I understand.
You know, it was confusing.
Yeah.
A little bit. And Marlene's exercises that we do, you know.
Those are hard. And
they are.
For me, I'm thinking just from a cultural difference. I'm Swedish, therefore I am awkward by blood. And it's, so,
wow.
yeah, so, I am the most uncomfortable person on within the Northern Hemisphere.
Wow.
And I can see, you know, the therapy sessions and exercises from a therapeutic point of view.
Yes.
And see that it's guaranteed helpful. But there was a part of me when they talked about the cuddle corner that made me want to just pack up my ovaries, my spleen, and my kidneys and just fuck off to Iceland.
Yes.
Hello and goodbye forever.
Yes.
Because it's Yeah, I'm an awkward person. Yeah.
It's very awkward.
It's in my culture. Damn it. So, but how was that? Because my view of Americans is that you're all, you know, so socially skilled. Did that help regarding the color quarter?
No.
No.
It did not help at all. Because it feels like a game.
Yeah.
It feels like and when you add Christianity or religion to that game, and the pain gets more severe.
Yeah.
Because it's again, I felt lost in how to act because I was trying to get rid of the social. Because my mom called me a social butterfly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was an escape. It was to show her, prove her subconsciously that I need to get away from you.
Yeah.
And this is in hindsight. I did not know I was doing this. But I would make myself, prove myself to her that I didn't need what she was giving me.
Yeah.
Even though I needed her. But in a different way, not the godly, not the religious way.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, because you need somebody to be a person, not a spiritual role model.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. I didn't even know. I still battle with what that is.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
They need to come at you from a human.
Yes.
Perspective.
Yes.
We spoke about this with the other group, that there is a difference because Paul says something in the documentary that resonated with me, that there's nothing that you can say that I cannot sit with you through.
Yes.
And I think in a way that we're so used to in Christianity to look to leaders to give us the answers.
Right.
And I think you internalize that role, that you have to have the answers all the time.
Yes.
But what we need when we're broken is somebody to sit with us.
Wow.
And be, don't worry, I'm fucked up as well, but I'm here to sit with you.
That's such a not even a concept of that happening. Yeah. Somebody, like going back to Cuddle Corner, somebody sitting there with me scared me to death.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I need to break out. I need to break out feeling, and somebody being there with me almost is just as scary as,
yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, I need to somehow break through this chain.
Yeah.
Of social, religious. Yeah. And be human person.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Nobody knows.
I know. And that feels better. Yeah. You know, because I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm going to ask you, Lindsay. There is a part in the documentary where you get a letter from your dad. And that made me think of the phrase for you. So Lindsay, former Baptist, you were speaking about earlier that you're a pastor's kid from a mega church in Houston, Texas.
Yeehaw.
Yeehaw. And the word that came to mind for me was infantilization. Mm-hmm. In that letter from your father, you read it out loud. And you can tell that it's, we love you, we want you to come back, and we want you to leave your job, leave your friends, leave everything behind, because the evil world has come to, if it's not bad people around you, it's the bad environment or the bad demons that are influencing you to make this choice. And you're still a grown woman. And right. That's what I mean with infantilization, that it's, yes, he loves you and he wants you to come back, but he doesn't give you the respect as an autonomous adult person.
Yeah.
So when you heard the word infantilizing, what did you think of that? What was the...
It's interesting. When I heard that word, I didn't even think that it applied to me until we started talking about it. And I was like, oh, shit, that is how that felt. I have always felt and processed that response from my dad in terms of feeling like all of my agency was stripped away.
Yeah.
And that there was no trust in me as a full, complex human being anymore, that I had no ability to think rationally or clearly. And these were things that they said directly to me during that time.
Wow. Yeah.
And I never really connected it to infantilization, but that's exactly what it is. It's like a mental or intellectual infantilization.
Yeah.
And it was so jarring for me because that letter, that response from my dad came the night of when I came out to my family as queer and agnostic.
At the same time?
At the same time. I
the enemy deserves no mercy.
Yep, starts. I just decided to wreak all kinds of havoc on myself. Yeah. one full blow. Yeah.
Sorry. That is one way of ripping the bandage off completely same time.
It's pretty insane. I mean, maybe I wasn't rational at all after all. Yeah. Maybe they were right.
Did you tell them you were queer before you told them you were agnostic or the other way around?
Before. I think the opening line was, I'm pansexual. I hope you know what that means. Okay. No, I'm just kidding. Not word for word, but I did, I did come out as pansexual first in the letter. And then I kind of had a lot to explain because I knew that they would be just utterly shocked or just totally confused and kind of like, where did this come from? Because before I was this like super passionate wannabe Christian apologist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I moved away for grad school and a few years later, I'm coming out as queer and a pansexual why did I say pansexual, honestly? Like
no, it's I love this because there is a in the Pentecostal church here in Sweden there's like a sort of it's been a long line of people that are not so fond of education because they seem to think that it leads to their children coming home as pansexual agnostics.
Yeah, so well, it does sometimes.
It does. That's not a bad thing to be.
No, it's been great so far. I that response from him was after he and my stepmom like received my coming out letter to them. And it was just beyond jarring. There isn't really even a word for it because I went like going back to the infantilization piece, like I went from being so respected, so loved, so cherished for my brain and for my rationality and my intellectual wits and that agency mentally and intellectually to overnight the exact opposite
and them opposite.
Over and over again telling me that clearly my mind has been taken
corrupted,
over corrupted that I'm dark and delusional and I'm clearly not thinking straight, I'm not thinking rationally anymore and all of that happened just literally overnight. And before this, I had never heard my parents like utter a single word, phrase, or sentiment in any way similar to that at all about me. And it was the opposite, just sheer praise and accolades all the time. And it, specifically about like my mind and my agency, my independence, like my self-assuredness as a woman. And then all of that came crashing down in the snap of a finger, like the rug was just pulled beneath me overnight. And so, like just this sudden, extreme infantilization that I don't feel that I've ever recovered from, like as in that it's still going on. Like,
Exactly. And it's also interesting because it shows that there is a problem with, it's like the whole emotional language of the church, regardless of which church, is infantile. Mm-hmm. Because it's all this bombardment of love and compliments and everything is over the top. And then when you leave, you're bitter, you're basically the whore of Babylon. And it, mm-hmm. it's, you have all these different, everything is so extreme. And that is a way a child reacts.
Yeah, like tantrums.
Yeah. I would like to ask you, Elena, you're ex-Mormon.
Right.
And what is your experience with the whole thing with infantilization within the Mormon church?
Yeah, when Lindsay was talking, I just was thinking of, like, that could be me talking, and it would be the same thing. I mean, my parents didn't praise me very much growing up. It was constantly being infantilized, and then especially when I started making decisions that they didn't agree with, even before I left the church, just, like, wanting to move out on my own and get a job instead of getting married and having babies. It was just like, I'm not capable of making those decisions. And what's really interesting is religion is always saying that you have to be childlike, be likened to a child. You know, they talk about born again. They don't talk about growing up and being an adult and making adult decisions. And then when you do, they tell you that you're incapable and that you're delusional and you can't possibly make these decisions. These are wrong. And it's just absurd.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Lindsay, when you read the letter, it's clear that your dad loves you. It's clear that he wants what's best for you. And it comes from a good place. And another thing I wrote down beside your name was weaponized love, mm-hmm. where you use love as a weapon to and a means to control and manipulate others. Yeah. It's the same thing as you insult people to the very core of who they are and use the excuse, I am telling you this because I am the only one that loves you enough to tell you the truth. And that is weaponized love. And that was a concern I had for you, actually, when I saw that, because now that you told me that your dad was a pastor of a mega church, that means also that you sort of have a standard to your name to uphold. So I can imagine that the pressure in the beginning was, how to summarize it, not fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I've had more fun times, than that.
Yeah. No, it's horrible. Yeah.
Wow. Again, I've never, you know, for English not being your first language, you've got a way with words, ma'am.
Thank you.
Like, again, I've never thought to describe it as weaponized love. Like, what a profound way to put that. Wow. Like in the letter, he said, I love you too much to lie to you.
Yeah.
I totally get where he's coming from. He does love me too much to not tell me his version of what he believes to be true. And I've never doubted his love for me. And to this day, I don't at all. And I know that it's immense. But he has a very different version of love, like, in his mind than I do.
Yeah.
And his version and his definition of love is based on this really particular theology that he lives and breathes, which tells him that if he doesn't say these things to me and doesn't try to save me, and whatever his definition of saving is, then I will burn in hell for all of eternity.
Yeah.
And he can't live with that.
No, of course not.
Yeah. So, like, on one hand, I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but it's, I mean, obviously I have a different definition of love than that. And like one of the other things that my parents have said to me before is like in other correspondences since I came out was that all of your friends, Lindsay, don't love you. They tell you that they love you, but they don't. They don't really love you. They're leading you down a path of destruction and into eternal hellfire.
Yeah.
And that is just enraging and so gutting because my friends have been my family, my life source. Like I've experienced the most abundant, unconditional love, the kind of love that the Bible says, like you're supposed to feel from God. Yeah. Like I have felt that from my friends.
Yeah.
So to have the arrogance and the ignorance to tell me that they don't actually love me, just enraging. Yeah. I mean, what a better way to make me like never want to come back to this.
Exactly. It's counterproductive in the very core sense of the word.
Yeah.
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 Thank you for that. I'm going to ask you to pass the mic to Elena. Hi, welcome. You
Hello.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exhausting.
Yeah,
but
I can imagine. The word I got from you is it's rage. Mm-hmm. There's a quote by you from the film where you said, "If God is real, I will fight him."
That's one of my favorite lines.
Yeah, it's a really, really good one. So were you surprised when you heard that rage was your word?
No.
No.
I was like, yeah, that's accurate.
Yeah. What would you say your relationship to the whole rage thing is now? Are you feeling that you're still in the same spot or have you moved on to other places?
I'm actually very proud of my rage.
Yeah.
I don't know if this was in the film. I was kind of overwhelmed watching it.
Yeah.
But I wasn't allowed to get angry when I was growing up in the church. Like, you weren't allowed to get angry. And you just had to suppress that all the time. And I have a memory of my dad yelling at us, "Don't get mad."
Really?
Which is just so ironic. And there were a lot of things that I needed to get angry about. And anger, like emotions serve a purpose.
Yeah.
Humans aren't, I learned this from Dr. Marlene Winnell. We're not hardwired for happiness. We're hardwired for survival. And so every emotion serves a survival purpose. And anger is like fire. You know, you can contain it in a cute little candle or in a campfire or even a bonfire. And that's okay. But, you know, if it's just all over the place and becomes a raging wildfire, that's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, but like even controlled wildfires can be healthy.
Yeah.
So like, I'm able to compartmentalize that rage and like keep it over here. And when I hear you need to let go of your anger and forget and forgive, that enrages me because that thinking is exactly why I stayed trapped in an abusive situation for so long. Yeah. And once I was finally able to get angry and not let go of it was when I was finally able to get away.
Yeah.
And so I hold on to my rage, but it's not like I'm going around just like growling all day or something.
That would be fun. I think you would be a really sought after singer.
I think
if you could learn to growl, and then I think there would be a lot of bands that would love to have you.
I could be a metal singer.
Yeah, exactly. But it is, you make a really, really good point because it is in some ways the rage can also be life-sustaining and a force, a driving force. Because I was thinking about the whole thing with the Mormon church as well, that even more so within the Mormon church, you are taught to, the saying, keep sweet.
Mm-hmm.
There is such a, you have the perfect Mormon wife. And they have this almost, a thing to do with the hair, I think. Because the perfect Mormons, they don't have the frizzy hair. They always have the really shiny hair.
Right, you're supposed to, like, always... I heard someone describe it recently of the Mormon glow.
Yeah.
And perfect. You're supposed to look good for God and just kind of be serene all the time. And on the flip side, like, not only are you not allowed to be angry, you can't be too excited. You can't be too happy. You just have to be serene and soft. And the missionaries in the film, she had the Mormon voice and the Mormon glow. And I was dying laughing because I'm just like, I remember that.
I think it's also really funny because I think the Mormon glow is how I would, how Swedish people sometimes would describe Norwegian people because it always looks like they are born and raised on Norwegian fjord salmon and spring water, and they have the just glow, you know, and there you go going, yes. So it is a very special culture.
Well, for Mormon women, I think they've changed the age limit now, but for boys you were mandatory supposed to go on a mission at 19, and for girls it was optional to go on a shorter mission at 21 if you didn't get married first.
Yeah.
And there was this pressure to get married before 21. And that is so disgusting to me.
Yeah, it's
and it was
so
like
strange,
a failure. Yeah. Like the sister missionaries were kind of seen as a failure. And it's like, well, you failed at getting married and popping out babies right away. So we guess we'll let you go on a mission, but a shorter one.
Exactly. But it is special, and I know you're supposed to even more in a way have a certain type of personality, and like you say, it's you can't be too happy, you can't be everything has to be controlled.
Yeah, just like this serene, soft sweetness all the time.
Yeah, the actual opposite of being a spectacle.
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Annika. Have you met me? So I think it's we have that as well in the like the free church and or the Pentecostal or the evangelical church that you're supposed to be a certain way, but that is like driven up to the max in the Mormon church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually had to go through a lot of therapy for a few years to be able to get angry because there were just so many situations like with my ex-husband abusing me that I needed to be angry at that. And instead I was just, I kept feeling sorry for him. And I kept feeling sad for him and like, oh, what is he going to do now that I've left him? And people were like, you need to get mad at this.
Yeah.
And so like, I needed to spend some time in therapy, just like focusing on learning to get angry. So I'm actually very proud of that, that rage is my word.
Yeah. I'm happy you are.
It's an accomplishment.
Yeah, because I was there, it's sister from another mystery. Because I can relate to the whole thing with the rage. And I think it's important as well, because you say one thing that I think is so profound in the film is that when this happened to you with your abusive ex-husband, you couldn't even fathom the fact that something was done to you.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, you internalized it, like we do all the time within the religion, and said, I did something wrong when something wrong happened to you. But you still have to pay the price. And it's infuriating. Could you pass the microphone to Dan? Hi, Dan.
Hi.
What is your experience with the word rage, that feeling, that sensation?
Yeah, there's two things that come to mind. The first is... I'm identifying it with, I made some pretty unwise and unhealthy decisions earlier in life, and someone was enraged at me. They were typical decisions, you know, nothing, but I didn't understand it then, and I do now.
Yeah.
In the sense that it's a way to process and to feel in a way that can be very healthy and motivating and provide a sense of, I don't really want to say closure, but a sense of accomplishment because I can feel something that, you know, is typically not allowed.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, why is it that the church, let's say, can continue to do and say whatever they want without repercussion.
Exactly.
But I can't continue to feel this.
No.
Why is that okay, but this is not okay? So I can feel rage for as long as I want.
Exactly.
Right. That's not for, you know, you, my abuser, yeah, to decide. So that's
that
what
is
came
a really valid point, because I was thinking about that. It's in a way, it's for me, I don't know if you relate to this, but for me, the whole thing with rage, it's in the same compartment as forgiveness, because it's been pressed upon us always that we have to forgive. We have to forgive everything. And it creates a really destructive culture within churches where people can go around and behave like utter assholes, mm-hmm, and be abusive because we're basically forced to forgive.
Yeah.
So for me, I think the whole thing with the forcing of forgiveness is so tightly wound with rage in,
yes,
a way. Can you relate to that? Yeah.
Very, very much so. I'm remembering like being forced to forgive, and anger is the natural response to whenever you've been violated. When,
yeah,
a boundary has been crossed, the natural response is to get angry, and you need to get angry so that you can correct the situation and survive and,
yeah,
defend yourself. You know, if someone comes up and slaps your child in the face, you need to get angry. You don't,
yeah,
need to forgive them.
Exactly.
And something that was church doctrine was that if we didn't forgive, then we would be held accountable to the same degree as the person who violated us.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that message was so harmful. And so every time, instead of feeling the natural emotion, I was feeling like this shame and this pressure to immediately forgive. And anytime I would,
yeah,
go to my parents when I was growing up, or like even as an adult, and I would talk to my friends and family, like, hey, this situation happened and it's messed up. Oh, well, make sure you forgive them. That was the immediate,
yeah,
response. Not like, hey, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to come fight for you. We're going to help get
you
out of the situation.
Okay?
Are you,
yeah,
okay? It's just like, well, you need to forgive,
yeah,
and do it right now. And if you don't, then you're going to go to hell.
Exactly. So. No, it's a horrible thing to enforce on somebody when something has been done to them.
Mm-hmm.
That the most important thing is not, how are you? How can we help? Are you okay? Do we need to see a doctor? Do we need to do this and this? It's, you have to, you've forgiven them, right?
Yeah. That's a really good observation. I hadn't put those two together, that rage and forgiveness within the church are so intertwined.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So we've come to Dan.
Hi.
Former charismatic Christian.
Yes.
The word that you got was robbed.
Mm-hmm.
What was your train of thought around that that word when you heard that?
You know, there's so many facets to that word for,
yeah,
me. And so it's hard to say just one.
Yeah.
At its core, really, I felt like when my parents, especially my mom, joined the charismatic movement, I was probably,
yeah,
11 or 12, and it almost feels like life stopped.
Yeah.
I was living a normal life, as normal as anyone in the suburbs of America, and just growing up and learning life as you go and making mistakes and learning from them and all those things. And all of a sudden it just stopped. And instead we were put in this setting where people had all the answers, and you needed to have faith. And
everything is spiritualized.
It touches on a lot of what we've said, the infantilizing.
Yeah.
And so you learn, you grow up a very different way.
Yeah.
And you look and see, like, I'm living life a very different way than my friends. I went to public school and,
yeah,
you know, like everything else. But it made me feel separate. And even then it didn't feel comfortable.
Like it creates a sense of isolation, because you become isolated from your peers within the school.
Yeah. Oh, very much so. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Yep. And so, and then that just continues through life. And so the normal process of growing up and discovering and whatnot, my wife now will play music that almost everyone should know. And I'm like, what's that song?
Exactly.
And like, I've heard it, but you know, who is it? Or no, I've never heard that at all. And it's like, you know, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
How could you've never heard that song? I'm like, we didn't listen to that kind of music, you know?
No, and, because I would imagine that I think it was during the 80s and 90s was the biggest like boom of contemporary Christian music.
Oh, and I destroyed. Yes.
I'm like, actually digging on that subject at the moment because we're doing a series of episodes on the matter. Yeah.
I mean, I'm the kid that destroyed all my albums, right?
Yeah.
My brother's still mad at me about that, but I, you know, like, and I look back, I'm like, why? And so that's sort of what I meant by raw. I was the 10% tither, right?
Exactly.
Which I later learned, like, no one really does. But I thought, oh, yes.
Of course,
I thought,
you're
well,
woman.
Well, of course everyone does it, because that's what they're saying to do.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's...
that's a huge part of the charismatic
movement. There's so many things.
Movement.
It's not like I want all of that back. But I feel I made conscious choices based on what I knew at the time.
Yeah.
And... I look back, I'm like, how many years did I spend investing in something that isn't true?
Exactly. And that is such a hard thing to process when you feel like you've, in a way, you never want to say wasted years. And for me, it's been crucial to make something of it. That's why I do this, for example, because... those years, they have to mean something.
Yes.
I do not agree with the option of them being useless. So this was actually sort of your part in the film was hit a hard spot in me, because that sense, that sensation of being robbed out of life, out of experiences... That is something that still haunts me to this very day, even though it's, what can it be, 17, 18 years ago that I left the church? And it's still something that I think about, all this, in a way, unlived life.
Yes. Like, I went on a university, I went on a 9-week mission trip to India.
Yeah.
And people say, have you, I have a lot of friends from that country now, and they say, have you been? I say, oh, yes, I went in college. And they're like, oh, you know, tell me about it. I do not want to talk about that.
No.
Because I was there as a Christian to convert anyone who is not a Christian.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. I still love that I went. But I feel like, how much did I lose out on?
Yeah.
Because of my point of view and what I was there to do. And it seems very disrespectful to me now to say why I was there.
No, I know the feeling completely. And it's one of my favorite things to collect is stories on really, really unsuccessful missionary trips. Why on earth would you send out 40 teenagers to some country where people are Catholic on a mission trip? It's just... the most stupid thing ever.
Such a waste of time and money.
So we're back to Jeff.
Back to Jeff.
What are your feelings on that phrase, to be robbed out of life, or just robbed?
I am so blown away right now, because I was just taking in what he was saying, coming up with what should I have to... typical things that I can be robbed of.
Yeah.
But just... this trip that I'm on, I think of just 10 seconds before you Dan started talking about music, that I just, music.
Yeah.
Because like you were saying about the Christian music, when I was in Bible college, it was huge. Striper. I don't know if
I know of. Yeah.
Yes. And it was such a gift to have that music. But I'm a huge Led Zeppelin fan.
Me as well.
Are you?
Yeah.
Well, I had to go underground to get an album from my brother who was not a Christian. Yeah. And I said, can you get this for me? It was In Through the Outdoor, Led Zeppelin album.
Oh.
And he got it. And my mom stole it from me. She took it. She took it. And I didn't know where it was. And I don't know how I found out, but she took it because it had a picture of a bar scene on it. And
that was blasphemous.
And then I was robbed because my battle with listening to the music, there was a big thing called backmasking.
Yeah.
That you're going to get infiltrated with these evil things.
The Stairway to Heaven.
Yes.
I think it's what you... That was the thing they said. When you play Stairway to Heaven backwards, it reads My Sweet Satan.
Yes.
which is, you can hear that if you really, really want to. You can also hear gibberish.
Yes.
Or nothing.
Yes. So. And I believe it was that song that I stopped. I'm saying, I can't do this. Mm. I'm going to get affected. So again, I'm robbed.
And you start policing yourself.
Yes.
Because all these things have been implemented into your brain.
Yeah.
So it's... again, with the what bothers me so much is that it's like training of dogs, and that is a harsh reality because it's a training of dogs to the point where they did not even need a leash around our necks because the leash is in the mind now.
Yeah,
and that is the horrific part.
It is
of the whole. Yeah, you it start is. Policing yourself.
I just had a teenager help me download Spotify. Just now, I don't have Spotify. And she was like, what? What? And I think there's just, I don't know how to explain it. I just don't want to, because I love the old music and I don't want it to become, you know, not new to me. So I think I push it away. So it's this a battle of being robbed.
Yeah, but you're in for a treat, man, when you start. Because
she made me buy the one that you have to pay for. Because you have to do that.
Yeah, you have to use the one that you pay for. Because it's just the ability to sit in some vehicle and put on Roll Me Up and Smoke Me When I Die by Willie Nelson at full blast. That is the sweetest moment you will ever have. I guarantee you.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
That is just awesome.
I'm going to pass the mic back. There we go. But since the documentary and everything that's happened, in a way, do you feel that you have been able to reclaim a part of that lost experience?
I don't think there's any reclaiming the years. It's more moving on. Yeah. I definitely feel like I've been able to move on. I really am trying to approach every day with just a sense of gratitude.
Yeah.
And that helps the most. The main gratitude is just being able to meet people and befriend them or get to know them exactly where they're at.
Yeah.
No judgment, just pure human to human friendship.
And curiosity,
yes.
As well, because that is, I think, the most important thing, to not lose your mind when you leave your religion, to be curious.
Mm-hmm.
That is the thing to carry you through all the hard times. When you go back and forth between, let's say, rage or lost at sea or feeling robbed or infantilization. And there is one thing you say in the film. How do you find help when there's no one to ask but other humans? And this is such a profound question, because you're an adult yourself, but you're in some way you just want somebody that's adultier. Somebody that's better at adulting. Help, in a way.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think Marlene expressed this too, and it came up in the film, that there's no easy answers.
Exactly.
It's like this need for closure is sort of a common driver of so much.
Yeah.
And learning to let go of even that.
Exactly.
It's like there may not be closure on this.
Yeah.
I just need to always learn.
Yeah.
And I might get a little more every day. I might not. I need to be okay with that.
We have to wrap this up now, but there is something. First, I want to thank you all for being here. It meant so much to me. I want to leave you with something that really carried me, kept me sane for many years when I was going through the hardships of leaving the faith. And it was a poem that I found when I was a teenager. But I think it's an American poet. It's Walt Whitman. He wrote a book called Leaves of Grass. And in it, there is a poem called To You. One of the sentences, it starts with describing that behind all the madness, behind all the faces we put up, he mentions the impure complexions and beneath all the bullshit. And then it says, I see you lurk. And that is the most beautiful way to describe a human I've ever read in my entire life, because there is something there that just, the essence. And in the end of the poem, it says, what you are picks its way. And I think that's such a profound truth in a way, because things have been taken from us and we need to reclaim some stuff and just let other stuff be. But what you are picks its way.
That's pretty freeing. Like, our only job is to lurk.
Yeah. To lurk.
That's it. That's it, guys.
Yeah.
We don't have to figure out anything else. Just lurk.
Exactly. Just lurk.
If you're a human being, yeah. Just lurk.
And what you are picks its way.
Yeah. It's great. Love it.
It's great. Yeah.
That's amazing.
So thank you all for being here. I'm going to do the finish in Swedish. Tack till alla som lyssnar, tack till alla Patreons och ha det gott. Hej.